Chapter 63. At the sense that no imperiousness of his could save him from it, but the task had to be gone through, and there was the administrative necessity of arranging things so that there should be as little annoyance as possible in the future. He was leaning against the corner of the fireplace. She looked up at him and said, bitterly, "All this is of no consequence to you. I and the children are importunate creatures. You wish to get away again, and be with Miss Harleth. Don't make the affair more disagreeable than it need be. Lydia, it is of no use to harp on things that can't be altered. Of course, it's deucedly disagreeable to me to see you making yourself miserable. I've taken this journey to tell you what you must make up your mind to. You and the children will be provided for as usual, and there's an end of it." Silence. She dared not answer. This woman with the intense, eager look cut at the iron of the mother's anguish in her soul, and it had made her sometimes capable of a repression harder than shrieking and struggle. But underneath the silence there was an outlash of hatred and vindictiveness. She wished that the marriage might make two others wretched, besides herself. Presently he went on, "It will be better for you. You may go on living here. But I think of by settling a good sum on you and the children, and you can live where you like. There will be nothing for you to complain of then. Whatever happens, you will feel secure. Nothing could be done beforehand. Everything has gone on in a hurry." Grandcourt ceased his slow delivery of sentences. He did not expect her to thank him, but he considered that she might reasonably be contented, if it were possible for Lydia to be contented. She showed no change, and after a minute he said, "You have never had any reason to fear that I should be liberal. I don't care a curse about the money. If you did care about it, I suppose you would not give it us," said Lydia. The sarcasm was irrepressible. "That's a devilishly unfair thing to say," Grandcourt replied, in a lower tone, "and I advise you not to say that sort of thing again. Should you punish me by leaving the children in beggary?" In spite of herself, the one outlet of venom had brought the other. "There is no question about leaving the children in beggary," said Grandcourt, still in his low voice. I advise you not to say things that you will repent of." "I am used to repenting," said she, bitterly. "Perhaps you will repent. You have already repented of loving me. All this will only make it uncommonly difficult for us to meet again. What friend have you besides me?" "Quite true." The words came like a low moan. At the same moment there flashed through her the wish that after promising himself a better happiness than that he had had with her, he might feel a misery and loneliness which would drive him back to her to find some memory of a time when he was young, glad, and hopeful. But no. He would go scatheless. It was she that had to suffer. With this the scorching words were ended. Grandcourt had meant to stay till evening. He wished to curtail his visit, but there was no suitable train earlier than the one he had arranged to go by, and he had still to speak to Lydia on the second object of his visit, which like a second surgical operation seemed to require an interval. The hours had to go by. There was eating to be done. The children came in. All this mechanism of life had to be gone through with the dreary sense of constraint which is often felt in domestic quarrels of a commoner kind. To Lydia it was some slight relief for her stifled fury to have the children present. She felt a savage glory in their loveliness, as if it would taunt Grandcourt with his indifference to her and them, a secret darting of venom which was strongly imaginative. He acquitted himself with all the advantage of a man whose grace of bearing has long been molded on an experience of boredom. Nursed the little Antonia, who sat with her hands crossed and eyes upturned to his bald head, which struck her as worthy of observation, and propitiated Henley by promising him a beautiful saddle and bridle. It was only the two eldest girls who had known him as a continual presence, and the intervening years had overlaid their infantine memories with a bashfulness which Grandcourt's bearing was not likely to dissipate. He and Lydia occasionally, in the presence of the servants, made a conventional remark, otherwise they never spoke. And the stagnant thought in Grandcourt's mind all the while was of his own infatuation in having given her those diamonds, which obliged him to incur the nuisance of speaking about them. He had an ingrained care for what he held to belong to his caste, and about property he liked to be lordly. Also he had a consciousness of indignity to himself in having to ask for anything in the world. But however he might assert his independence of Mrs. Glasher's past, he had made a past for himself which was a stronger yoke than any he could impose. He must ask for the diamonds which he had promised to Gwendolyn. At last they were alone again, with the candles above them, face to face with each other. Grandcourt looked at his watch, and then said, in an apparently indifferent drawl, "There is one thing I had to mention, Lydia. My diamonds, you have them?" "Yes, I have them," she answered promptly, rising and standing with her arms thrust down and her fingers threaded, while Grandcourt sat still. She had expected the topic, and made a resolve about it. But she meant to carry out her resolve, if possible, without exasperating him. During the hours of silence he had longed to recall the words which had only widened the breach between them. "They are in this house, I suppose?" "No, not in this house. I thought you said you kept them by you." "When I said, so it was true. They are in the bank at Dudley. Get them away, will you? I must make an arrangement for your delivering them to someone." "Make no arrangement. They shall be delivered to the person you intended them for." "I will make the arrangement." "What do you mean?" "What I say. I have always told you that I would give them up to your wife. I shall keep my word. She is not your wife yet." "This is foolery," said Grandcourt, with undertone disgust. It was too irritating that this indulgence of Lydia had given her a sort of mastery over him in spite of dependent condition. She did not speak. He also rose now, but stood leaning against the mantelpiece with his side face toward her. "The diamonds must be delivered to me before my marriage," he began again. "What is your wedding day?"
"The 10th.
There is no time to be lost. And where do you go after the marriage?" He did not reply except by looking more sullen. Presently he said, "You must appoint a day before then, to get them from the bank, and meet me, or somebody else I will commission. It's a great nuisance, mention a day." "No, I shall not do that. They shall be delivered to her safely. I shall keep my word." "Do you mean to say," said Grandcourt, just audibly, turning to face her, "that you will not do as I tell you?"
"Yes, I mean that," was the answer that leaped out, while her eyes flashed close to him.
The poor creature was immediately conscious that if her words had any effect on her own lot, the effect must be mischievous, and might nullify all the remaining advantage of her long patience. But the word had been spoken. He was in a position the most irritating to him. He could not shake her, nor touch her hostilely, and if he could, the process would not bring his mother's diamonds. He shrank from the only sort of threat that would frighten her if she believed it. And in general, there was nothing he hated more than to be forced into anything like violence even in words. His will must impose itself without trouble. After looking at her for a moment, he turned his side face toward her again, leaning as before, and said, "Infernal idiots that women are. Why will you not tell me where you are going after the marriage?"
"I could be at the wedding if I liked, and learn in that way," said Lydia, not shrinking from the one suicidal form of threat within her power.
"Of course, if you like, you can play the mad woman," said Grandcourt, with sotto voce scorn. "It is not to be supposed that you will wait to think what good will come of it, or what you owe to me." He was in a state of disgust and embitterment quite new in the history of their relation to each other. It was undeniable that this woman, whose life he had allowed to send such deep suckers into his, had a terrible power of annoyance in her, and the rash hurry of his proceedings had left her opportunities open. His pride saw very ugly possibilities threatening it, and he stood for several minutes in silence reviewing the situation, considering
how he could act upon her. Unlike himself, she was of a direct nature, with certain simple, strongly colored tendencies, and there was one often experienced effect which he thought he could count upon now. As Sir Hugo had said of him, Grandcourt knew how to play his cards upon occasion. He did not speak again, but looked at his watch, rang the bell, and ordered the vehicle to be brought round immediately. Then he removed farther from her, walked as if in expectation of a summons, and remained silent without turning his eyes upon her. She was suffering the horrible conflict of self-reproach and tenacity. She saw beforehand Grandcourt leaving her without even looking at her again, herself left behind in lonely uncertainty, hearing nothing from him, not knowing whether as he had done her children harm, feeling that as he had perhaps made him hate her. All the wretchedness of a creature who had defeated her own motives. And yet she could not bear to give up a purpose which was a sweet morsel to her vindictiveness. If as he had not been a mother, she would willingly have sacrificed herself to her revenge, to what she felt to be the justice of hindering another from getting happiness by willingly giving her over to misery. The two dominant passions were at struggle. She must satisfy them both. "Don't let us part in anger, Henley," she began, without changing her voice or attitude, "colon, it is a very little thing I ask. If I were refusing to give anything up that you call yours, it would be different. That would be a reason for treating me as if you hated me. But I ask such a little thing. If you will tell me where you are going on the wedding day, I will take care that the diamonds shall be delivered to her without scandal." "Without scandal," she repeated entreatingly. "Such preposterous whims make a woman odious," said Grandcourt, not giving way in look or movement. "What is the use of talking to mad people? Yes, I am foolish. Loneliness has made me foolish. Indulge me." Sobs rose as she spoke. If you will indulge me in this one folly, I will be very meek. I will never trouble you." She burst into hysterical crying, and said again almost with a scream, "We'll be very meek after that." There was a strange mixture of acting and reality in this passion. She kept hold of her purpose as a child might tighten its hand over a small stolen thing, crying, and denying all the while. Even Grandcourt was wrought upon by surprise. This capricious wish, this childish violence, was as unlike Lydia's bearing as it was incongruous with her person. Both had always had a stamp of dignity on them. Yet she seemed more manageable in this state than in her former attitude of defiance. He came close up to her again, and said, in his low imperious tone, "Be quiet, and hear what I tell you. I will never forgive you if you present yourself again and make a scene." She pressed her handkerchief against her face, and when she could speak firmly said, in the muffled voice that follows sobbing, "I will not if you will let me have my way. I promise you not to thrust myself forward again. I have never broken my word to you. How many have you broken to me? When you gave me the diamonds to wear, you were not thinking of having another wife. And I now give them up. I don't reproach you. I only ask you to let me give them up in my own way. Have I not borne it well? Everything is to be taken away from me, and when I ask for a straw, a chip, you deny it me." As he had spoken rapidly, but after a little pause she said more slowly, her voice freed from its muffled tone, "colon, I will not bear to have it denied me." Grandcourt had a baffling sense that he had to deal with something like madness. He could only govern by giving way. The servant came to say the fly was ready. When the door was shut again, Grandcourt said sullenly, "We are going to Rylands then." "They shall be delivered to her there," said Lydia, with decision. "Very well, I am going." He felt no inclination, even to take her hand. She had annoyed him too sorely. But now that as he had gained her point, she was prepared to humble herself, that she might propitiate him. "Forgive me, I will never vex you again," she said, with beseeching looks. Her inward voice said distinctly, "'Tis is only I who have to forgive." Yet she was obliged to ask forgiveness. "You had better keep that promise. You have made me feel uncommonly ill with your folly, said Grandcourt, apparently choosing this statement as the strongest possible use of language. Poor thing! Cried Lydia, with a faint smile. Was he aware of the minor fact that he made her feel ill this morning? But with the quick transition natural to her, she was now ready to coax him, if he would let her, that they might part in some degree reconciled. She ventured to lay her hand on his shoulder, and he did not move away from her. As he had so far succeeded in alarming him, that he was not sorry for these proofs of returned subjection. Light a cigar, she said, soothingly, taking the case from his breast pocket and opening it. Amidst such caressing signs of mutual fear they parted. The effect that clung and gnawed within Grandcourt was a sense of imperfect mastery. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.